I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Welcome to Town Square. This week, Governor Ige made good on most of his intent to veto list. Of the 15 bills, he rejected 13 of them, including the heavily lobbied aquarium fish collection bill. The other two became law without his signature. Today on Town Square, we'll look at the bills he vetoed, preview the upcoming special legislative session on rail funding, and consider issues and policies that have Hawaii and the federal government in opposite camps. We'll also hear Governor Ige's thoughts about his re-election bid, and we want to hear from you, too. Our number is 941-3689 on Oahu and 877-941-3689 if you call us from the neighbor islands or if you're listening to the live stream. Governor Ige, welcome back.
Aloha. I'm glad to be here.
Good to talk to you again. Now, the vetoed bills, well, we knew that, you know, you put out your list last month and most likely they were going to be vetoed. But the two that you didn't sign and didn't veto that had been on the list, those were the releasing of public lands bill and the DAGS recycling bill. What lessened your objections to those to just let them become law?
I think a couple things. On the leasing of lands and the ability to negotiate, I recognize that there is a huge challenge for commercial and industrial leases on Hawaii Island specifically, that the lessees have a dilemma because they want to make investments to continue their business operations. But when you're at the end of the lease, it's hard to get financing. You know, you need to get to a more stable consideration in order for that to happen. So I understand, I listened, I heard the concerns of many of the lessees. The reason that it was on the veto list was because of legal issues that the Attorney General's office had identified. And in my assessment, I did hear from those most affected. I thought that the solution that was proposed by the legislature was a fair balance of how do you determine what a fair market value is, and at the same time, give consideration to these businesses who have had and held the leases, made significant investments in the property, and allow them to continue to operate their businesses. And let's be very clear that many of them are providing quality services to the communities in a wide variety of areas. And so in looking at the analysis, I know that by not vetoing the measure, that there may be legal issues that remain on those measures, but I thought that the tenants deserved the opportunity to move forward and try out this system of balancing the private interest against the broader public interest. On the recycling bill, I did have a chance to speak with Representative Lopresti, who was the advocate on behalf. Our reason for vetoing it is that we do have quite extensive recycling programs in most of our buildings already, and so we just thought for the most part that mandating that we should do recycling was somewhat redundant, and the representative just shared with me that he thought that the program at the state capitol was not as robust as it could be. And I did acknowledge that. And so, you know, we'll be working with him and seeing what we might be able to do at the state capitol. You know, we do have quite robust recycling programs that already exist at most state buildings.
So with those two, they're going to have the opportunity to be tested in real life.
Absolutely.
The bill that had so many people stirred up, and even before we went on air yesterday, we were getting calls and emails about the aquarium bill and people saying, you know, how could you in good conscience do this, not sign this bill, put this on your veto list and then veto it? Clearly, you took thousands of calls on both sides, heavily lobbied. And yet this idea that, well, perhaps there could be a meeting of the minds among those groups. But with this emotionally charged issue, is that really possible for everybody to sit down and come to some agreement?
Well, certainly we are committed to bringing all advocates and all parties to the table to talk about it. by far this measure was the most debated and most active in our office. We received hundreds and thousands of communications, phone calls, emails on this measure, both in support of and in opposition to. I've met with representatives of the advocates. I met with those who had requested veto, the staff at DLNR, and many others. I had more meetings on this measure since even before placing it on the veto list and then subsequent to it being on the veto list than any other measure that was before the legislature. At the end of the day, when I had spoken with both sides and tried to make a final decision, my sense is this: the law that was passed was flawed, and clearly I felt like it wouldn't allow us to make progress in better managing the aquarium fishery. You know, the bill essentially was a moratorium, kind of a status quo, and it didn't really advance any of what we know is good management practice that would allow us to manage the fishery better. The West Hawaii fishery, aquarium fishery, accounts for about 80% of the fish that are sold to aquarium distributors, and it's well managed. We have a series of fish replenishment areas where no taking of fish is allowed, and then open areas that the fishermen are able to collect fish at, and we have lots of data, more than 6,000 surveys in that area that talks about and tracks the populations of the most collectible of aquarium fish. And so we do believe that with good management, we can develop sustainable fisheries for aquarium fish, and, you know, support the industry continuing. So at the end of the day, I just decided that I would veto this measure. I am, and Chair Case and the department is committed to convening both advocates and opponents to really begin to talk about how can we take the best practices that we've learned in managing the West Hawaii fisheries and really expand it to statewide. So part of that is permitting and whether there should be limits to permits, whether there should be fees assessed, identifying fish replenishment areas all across the state. You know, we have implemented a robust series of resource management efforts across the state, from subsistence fishing and really limiting to community-based fisheries management, and to what we do on West Hawaii. And it really is our commitment and effort to bring all parties together and really think about what do we need to do to manage our ocean resources in a much more sustainable way for the future of Hawaii.
Given, though, that you have such emotions around this, we talked about this a little earlier, being so emotionally charged, to get people to come and sit down around the table itself may be a feat when you have those who are saying they want to see, you know, the gate closed, and others who are saying, but wait a minute, this is our livelihood. How do you get them in the middle?
I think, and that was the challenge, the bill that was before me did neither. You know, it neither closed the gates nor did it make for better resource management. And at the end of the day, that's why I decided to veto it. We have reached out and we have received positive comments from both sides that they are willing to engage and be part of this dialogue. And hopefully we'll have a more comprehensive measure to present to the legislature next session.
And maybe with some real definitions of what sustainable means.
Absolutely.
All right, we're going to move on. I want to ask you about the bill that you didn't like, the idea that the AG would be compelled to defend counties for a lifeguard's action. And the lifeguards, as we know now, are left with no protection because the liability shield, whatever they had, sunset on June 30th. Lawmakers couldn't agree to extend that during the last session. is it in fact maybe unnecessary, given what you said in your rationale for the veto, that the Attorney General will defend any civil action or proceeding based on the acts or omissions of county lifeguards working on state beaches that are within the scope of the lifeguards' duties?
Yes, the reason for that veto was that we did not want the public to misunderstand that this measure was a replacement for the liability, a measure that died. The Attorney General and the state of Hawaii is committed to having ocean safety officers on the beaches all around the state. And we do believe that the county is the best organization to be able to provide those services. We have discussions and will complete agreements, memorandums of understanding to ensure that the county personnel will be protected and defended by the Attorney General. I don't need legislation to have that happen. We can do that by executive order. And we, more importantly, wanted to be clear with the counties that we're not going to defend them in any and all actions, that we clearly will defend them when they are working on behalf of the state to provide services on state beaches, but we would not be carte blanche defending them for any and all lawsuits that could be could result because of the employees being at the beaches.
We're going to talk about the special session coming next month in just a minute. We have a few callers on the line. If you'd like to join us, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Jackie calling us from Makakilo. Aloha, Jackie.
Aloha. I was just wondering if I could ask the governor, what is his position on collecting taxes from Airbnb hosts?
All right. Thanks very much for the question. Now, we know that we're going to be collecting taxes for the GET through Amazon and other similar businesses. Clearly, taxes are looking like they're going to be increasing, given what the Council on Revenue said last month, and we're waiting to see what happens on August 1st. But she has a point. Should you be collecting taxes from Airbnb?
Let's be very clear. Those who operate Airbnbs are required by law to pay both a general excise tax and a transit accommodations tax, and they should be licensed for both of those activities. And if they're not, then they're in violation of the law. You know, Airbnb had proposed legislation that would facilitate the collection of taxes. And clearly, if I was to take a selfish position purely from the state's perspective and think about what would make it easiest for the state to collect the taxes owed, I should have signed the bill that was passed last year. But I was concerned about that proposal because I felt that it facilitated illegal activity, that it, because there was no way to verify whether that Airbnb was operating in a area that was appropriately zoned. And that was the reason for the veto last year. I continue to speak with the Airbnb providers and other platforms that are facilitating the transactions. And we are working to see if we can come up with voluntary agreements for them to collect the taxes. And we continue to work through anyone, just as we did with Amazon, to help facilitate taxes that are already on the books and already owed to the state.
Thanks, Jackie, for the question. If you want to join us, 941-3689 is our number on Oahu, or from the neighbor islands, 877-941-3689. We know that in about 6 weeks, we're going to be in a special session and trying to pick up the pieces from where we were left at the end of the regular session, where there were really no answers about how we would see rail funded with a great shortfall. And a lot of people felt they were just left hanging. Is there really, in your mind, a deal to be brokered, and any indication that the state is considering other ways of completing the route? And I'm sure you're hearing, as we've talked about, the at-grade from Middle Street idea. Are you willing to even entertain such an alternative?
I am a big fan of mass transit, transit systems in general, and that includes all aspects, bus, fixed rail. light rail. As I've traveled to various communities all around the world, I do believe that it is a quality of life issue, that those communities that have good mass transit systems have a better quality of life. Clearly, I've been a big proponent, supporter of the bus system and the transit systems, because I do believe when well implemented, it improves the quality of life. It allows our citizens to move about our communities much easier and more effectively. So I am open and continue to work with the House and the Senate to provide information. They've been talking about a number of options. I've told people that I am open to any revenue source that they would want to consider. You know, obviously others impact the constituents differently and the communities differently, and so we need to be thoughtful about that. But we need to move forward on the transit system. We've started construction and it's made its way. As you know, Bethann, I've represented IM Pro City for all of my public service career. And the transit system, the guideway, is through IAM Pro City and making its way into town. And certainly we are committed and we need to finish that project. The legislature, and we will be working with the county, the state legislature, to identify revenue sources. Wes Machida, my budget director, has been actively engaged with both the House and Senate as they consider different ideas and different revenue sources. And we've been working to find the best information that we can, you know, and the speaker and the Senate president has announced a date for the special session. And so we are working and focused on finding consensus before that.
That's really geared toward the financial part of it.
Yeah.
But this idea that's been resurging, and now again, there's going to be a public talk at the Capitol tomorrow, late afternoon, about changing how rail comes into town. Do I understand from you that that's not something that you would be willing to entertain, that this idea of going at grade at Middle Street is just off the table as far as you're concerned?
Well, it hasn't been presented as an idea for funding from the HART board. I mean, the HART board is truly empowered to design the system that will be implemented, and certainly I hope that they are looking at different alternatives. I've suggested in previous discussions that we ought to look at private sector participation. I've met with developers who said that they would be interested in at least having a conversation about what might be possible. And so definitely if there are other kinds of changes that the HART board would contemplate, I'd be more than willing to discuss them. But, you know, the state's participation in the transit project is really supporting the financing of the preferred option. And the formal preferred option of the Honolulu area transit system is the fixed heavy rail that is currently defined.
Are you at all concerned, because the head of HART is only an interim head, and that we don't really have a sense that there will be continuity, that something may be talked about or started or agreed to now, and then he will leave and someone else will come in and hand off, and there will be that lack of continuity?
I do think that it's important that we get continuity of leadership in the project. Yes, I am concerned that the current head of the HART project is on an interim basis. I hope that the board members can find someone to lead the project, because I believe it's fundamentally important.
We've got another tax question for you. John calling us from Manoa. Aloha, John. Welcome to Town Square, and thank you for your patience.
Aloha. I just had a question about potential non-residency property tax.
All right. Thank you for the question. That's really not in your bailiwick.
That's not in our bailiwick. But you know, property tax and the general excise tax, that that question comes up a lot. I was on Maui and spent some time meeting with community members, and they had asked about property taxes and about the counties getting a larger share of the transit accommodations tax as one of the things, and asked whether I had supported that. And I have said before that, you know, the state is responsible for many functions that are funded with property taxes in virtually every other community across the country. Public education, community hospitals, as we were working with supporting the community hospitals on Maui. The jails, the county jails are usually funded through property taxes in most jurisdictions. And all of those functions, public schools is the biggest service that the state provides, are generally funded predominantly with property taxes. And in the state of Hawaii, we don't get a single penny for any of those services. And so I tell people, I do, when I look at the responsibilities of state government and the revenue sources that we have, we don't have access to property taxes. We have the general excise tax, we have personal income tax, we have business taxes, and the transient accommodations taxes. I have difficulty funding all of the services that the state is responsible for. And certainly I work with the mayors and the county councils to find a balance, but I really believe that I need to be a little bit selfish at this point in time. We don't have enough funds to support the public schools as it is, and I'm committed to really providing them with additional revenue so that we can move forward.
The last time that we sat down, we talked about your meeting with the other governors. Also, we got to see President Trump. Now we're 6 months into the Trump administration, and Hawaii has repeatedly challenged the Trump executive order on travel. Hawaii has received some national attention for that, too. How do you see these challenges as perhaps setting up Hawaii as a watchdog for other issues? And is that an appropriate role for us?
I am proud to serve as governor of the state of Hawaii, and I do believe that broadly across our community, we have core values that we all share. Yeah, I'm proud of the sense of community that most of our constituents and the citizens of Hawaii have, that they understand that we live in a very limited resource community. What I do impacts my neighbors. And we have to collectively make some decisions about moving forward. So clearly in my discussions with the Attorney General Doug Chin and the rest of the cabinet, you know, we've decided that we will stand up and lead in those issues that we believe are fundamental principles or values that represent something that is very important to our community. And so we will continue to do that. It's not so much about taking on the Trump administration. It really is about the checks and balances that are guaranteed and provided for in the Constitution. We want to make sure that we exercise those abilities to challenge the president and the administration when appropriate, and take that to court so that we can define what the parameters of presidential authority is.
There are so many areas that would impact Hawaii negatively, watching what's been happening with the EPA, a very changed EPA. Clearly, Hawaii has a vested interest in environmental issues. What has been floated as perhaps changing the parameters of Papahānaumokuakea. Also, looking at Medicaid dollars that may be sliced and what happens. So, I mean, a lot of angst between what's happening in Washington and what we are, or rather the angst that we're feeling here because of what's happening in Washington. Are you also identifying other areas that perhaps we haven't even thought about in which Hawaii would be quite negatively impacted by a very changed administration?
Certainly, I can tell you that the communication between the governor's office and the state of Hawaii in general and the congressional delegation has really accelerated, and we definitely are having more conversations, exchanging more information. I think the congressional delegation has done a terrific job in advocating and defending the programs that are most important to the state of Hawaii. yes, they are in the minority, and so they have a reduced role, but they've been very active in speaking out, especially for those programs that are most important to us. You know, the entire cabinet has been put on alert. We are doing a lot better job of communicating with those program managers and funders in the state government to be abreast of the kinds of proposals that are being made. We do have a team here in the governor's office that is focused at federal funding, and as these measures come up, working with the congressional delegation to be alerted to what some of those proposals are. And then we are working to identify the specific impacts. So yes, there are concerns, but you know, we continue to be hopeful that the system of checks and balances and the fact that the Congress is the body that appropriates, they're the body that changes laws, they're the body that can add or diminish programs. So certainly we will be working with them to protect those programs that are most important to Hawaii.
You mentioned working more with the congressional delegation, having greater conversations and having them more frequently. We're also watching social media play into this in a very different way. The tenor of a lot of the exchanges is very different from what it would have been a year ago. Is that also something that you are seeing happen within your own administration in the way you're communicating both with the congressional delegation and also with everyone in Hawaii?
Certainly, I do think that social media has, it actually is a double-edged sword, in my opinion. You know, I do and have concerns. You know, the fact that on the internet your identity is obscured and is not explicit allows people to really be meaner and more abrasive and confrontational than they might be if you were actually having a conversation face-to-face with someone. And I'm very much concerned that that has escalated the angst, the confrontation, the challenges, and really divided many in our community. It also allows us to an easier, more efficient way to communicate with people. So we definitely at the state level have tried to step up and provide more information through social media and think about how we can get the best information out to the community and the public. I think it's a balance. And I think like many all across the country, the social media effort and the fact that the president has really made Twitter and social media a main channel of communication is changing everything that we do.
If you want to join the conversation with Governor Ige, you can call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. One of the real issues of concern that we've been talking about now for many, many, many months is the continual testing of ICBMs by North Korea and what that would mean for Hawaii. But is there enough concern for Hawaii's vulnerability and not just the U.S. West Coast? I mean, in some of the articles that we see, Hawaii is not even mentioned. It's just concern for could they hit California?
We are definitely working with the Pacific Command and those in the Department of Defense and State Department to monitor and be aware of North Korea and their progress. We know that the leader of North Korea is investing significant resources to develop that capability. We are confident that today that they probably don't have the ability to attack Hawaii directly. But we also believe in being prepared and updating our emergency procedures. When we looked at the last time the emergency preparedness documents were reviewed and included the possibility of a missile attack, it was in the 80s, and we definitely know that Hawaii has changed dramatically since that. So we are going through and examining all of our preparedness documents and making sure that we include the possibility of a missile attack as part of that. The reality of that is, though, is that from a launch to impact is 20 minutes, and there really isn't a whole lot of time for a lot of activity. We are committed to work with the Department of Defense to strengthen the defensive ability of the United States, and especially as it comes to protecting the assets in the state of Hawaii. But I think it really is ensuring that as we evaluate and renew our preparedness efforts, that we include the possibility of a missile strike as part of that.
There are there are some who've also raised the idea that some very old technology might be able to wipe out the grid, an electromagnetic pulse, something that would be more easily affected perhaps than having to be so concerned about what a missile might do. Is enough attention going to that possibility too?
There definitely is increased awareness in critical infrastructure around the country. At the Western Governors Association, we had a conversation about infrastructure, about other terrorists and disruptive actions that could be taken. Certainly, there has been more attention to it. We've been from the government and really looking to how we can provide and share more information with the private sector. As you know, much of the infrastructure in the country is operated in the private sector, the electric utilities, the telephone utilities, and all of that. And so we have made a bigger effort of including key providers in the private sector in the information that is shared about potential terrorist attacks or disruptions. And I think that we are in a better position than we were, let's say, 5 years ago to stop and mitigate any attack on the infrastructure. There is much more work to be done, but I think that that would apply to all, as our communities are changing, as society has changed, the threat of terrorism and the fact that these oftentimes are almost random acts of violence against innocent people. It's very hard to predict when and where it will occur. And what we are focusing our efforts on is being prepared in monitoring and trying to be proactive to diffuse potentially disruptive activities, and most importantly, trying to help our communities be more resilient, to be better prepared themselves. We know that government cannot provide any and all services when a natural disaster or a terrorist activity occurs. It really is the best scenario that our individuals, our communities are prepared.
That can only go so far when you say, like, there would be 20 minutes before we might feel impact from something, it were a missile launched toward us. Also, the fact that there are certain things that people in many ways can't do for themselves. They can't necessarily keep their own electrical needs going. Some may have the ability to do that, but most don't. But looking at it from the fact that Hawaii is so isolated, are we really getting enough attention?
I do believe we're getting a lot of attention. I've had conversations with the command at Pacific Command. I've had several conversations with members of the congressional delegation to talk about what long-range investments need to be made both within Hawaii and outside of Hawaii.
And from the military.
Right, military investments and else. We also, as you are aware, Bethann, the commands, the heads of the Navy, Army, Air Force, and Marines, and Coast Guard for the entire Pacific region is headquartered in Hawaii. And so they have assets and that to protect, and they definitely are taking action to ensure that those assets are protected as well. So, I'm confident that we continue to work together That it is a balance about providing additional resources for long-term defense systems. We do have short-term responses to be able to defend the state and the assets in the state. You know, one of the things that became very evident, you know, most of the time with the emergency sirens, people might have forgotten that we have different sirens to warn of different disasters. And clearly, instituting a missile attack siren so that people can understand, because of the time frames involved, and be alerted that that really does mean get indoors, shelter in place, find a safe place indoors to be, because it is 20 minutes, is part of that conversation, part of that educational program that we will be rolling out to the public.
Some would say, would it even be worth it? Because you know, to get inside, but inside may not necessarily offer you very much shelter.
Certainly, when we looked at the old plans, they were 400-something buildings that were identified as potential shelter facilities that that one could go to. It's 30 years later, and many of those buildings don't even exist. So I think it really is about informing and educating the public about what kinds of facilities may serve as good shelters. And as we said, the time frame involved is short. So it really is about getting indoors, getting into a building or a facility that can provide you the best protection that you can, and then, you know, prepare and shelter.
Let's move on. We've got Amy calling us from Kahului. Aloha, Amy. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi, I'm calling to get the governor's opinion on how many of the natural resources from the from the neighbor islands are being sand mined and mined, for example, the pohaku for mixed aggregate sand from the Central Maui sand.
Amy, we're really having a difficult time talking to you.
We would like to know the governor's position. State Historic Preservation has been unable to tell the developer to be mindful of these burials. The county is issuing permits. The county of Maui is issuing permits in known burial areas. We have blue tarps indicating burials throughout the development of Maui Lani. And furthermore, once the natural resources of the neighbor islands are depleted, those that do not have burials,
Amy, I'm sorry to tell you this, but we're really losing your call, and I'm really sorry. But she's concerned about natural resources being depleted, specifically on Maui. Now, yesterday we talked to Maui Mayor Alan Arakawa, and he mentioned that, you know, he has come to agreement with the companies involved that the sand isn't going to be sent to other islands. It may be there for Maui's use, but she's bringing up the issue about burials. He also said that there are those who are there involved with the process who are concerned with the cultural aspects of it as well as the environmental aspects of it. But from your perspective, how do you look at this one island or one place taking from the other?
Well, a couple things. One, just to be clear, that we do have laws on the books that protect burial sites, and there are very explicit legal requirements for anyone who is developing who comes across a burial. And certainly we are working to ensure that State Historic Preservation Office is staffed sufficiently and that we can respond when that occurs. So if there are specific locations where she believes that burials are being uncovered and not responded to appropriately, then we can help her. She should be calling the State Historic Preservation Office. You know, in terms of the movement of resources between islands, you know, I believe that the less movement we have between islands, the better off we all are. But you know, I'm not familiar enough with what the specific needs are and what resources are being moved between islands. There is specific protocols to ensure for example, that invasive species aren't caught up in that, and that it is safe to move whatever natural resources there might be. You know, I am committed to better managing all of the natural resources we have, and certainly if there are mining of resources from one island and moving them to another in an uncontrolled way, that's not a good situation to be in.
While we're talking about movements among islands, I want to talk to you a bit about homelessness. You refocused that issue a few years ago. This year's point in time count showed a 9% decrease statewide. A little less than 0.5% increase on Oahu was part of that. That's where most of Hawaii's population lives, though, and that makes it appear to folks on Oahu, perhaps, that this is a static situation. They're still seeing them. Is this giving more people a reason to be perhaps less compassionate toward homelessness individuals, including veterans?
I don't believe it's causing people. Obviously, there has been much media attention focused on homelessness, and there are more homeless people here on Oahu. But all of our efforts over the past 2.5 or 3 years or so are starting to gel and come together. You know, the fact that the federal, state, and county is working together on making resources available and joint efforts on projects. You know, we had the groundbreaking on Kahuiki Village, that project with Duane Kirisu, that the state and the county and federal government is partnering, that should develop hundreds of permanent homes for homeless families, I think is one example of that effort. And at that effort is actually an international effort, as businesses in Japan had provided the house, the containerized housing that was part of the Tohoku earthquake relief efforts. I think just kind of demonstrate about the entire community coming together. So we are making progress. You know, I think if you talk to the service providers, we have gotten them to understand it's really about making the system work better. It's not about, if you operate an emergency shelter, the objective is to get someone off of the street into shelter for a short period of time, a month or several months, and the objective is to place them in permanent housing and not keep them in the emergency shelter.
Which seems to be making a case for things like tiny houses.
Yes.
And there was some concern about the fact that you weren't supportive of that bill.
Well, just to be clear, the bill that I vetoed that allowed tiny houses on agricultural parcels, the reason I vetoed that measure is that current law already provides that ability. And in fact, the county of Hawaii already has provisions in their law that allows for homes as small as 250 square feet to be built on agricultural zoned lands for farm workers. So the reason I vetoed was not so much that there's not a need. It really was that the county of Hawaii specifically had already responded and had set up a process so that they could have small, tiny homes on farmlands already for workers.
So this was redundancy again in your
it's
mind.
It's redundancy, and it really is about appropriate level of law and oversight. You know, we just felt that it would become, if we started to enact laws specific to each county to deal with farm dwellings on farm or agricultural land, we just thought it would get confusing and be redundant.
Of all the subpopulations of homeless people, are there any in particular that need more attention? Some have suggested that youth are not really getting enough attention.
Well, we have focused on families because certainly having homeless families and having being out on a streets as families brings in bigger challenges for that community. We want the children to be able to to go to school and be in a permanent housing situation is definitely better. So we have focused on that. There has been a national effort, and the mayors on our counties have supported the efforts to eliminate homeless veterans. You know, for those who chose to wear the uniforms of our nations, being able to and willing to risk their lives to protect the freedoms and our democracy, we believe that they deserve more focus and specific effort to get them off of homeless. And the third area that we are putting focus on is really about the chronic habitual homeless, and how can we work with them, identify what their needs are, and really convince them that life in a permanent supportive housing situation is preferable to being out on the streets.
So where does that leave unsheltered youth? I mean, some of the counts said about 170. Providers said, no, it looks more like 1,000. You need to know where to look for these kids. But they don't have any other place to go. They're drop-in shelters. Maybe they can get a locker, leave their things there, go in, go out. But no real place where they can have a peaceful night of safety.
Well, like I said, I think that there are a number of shelters that are focused on providing a space for children who are homeless and out on the streets. You know, the Family Action Center that we opened in Kaka'ako has had a good success with bringing children and families off the streets and being able to place them in permanent situations. So I do think that we need to have more spaces for children and families, and we continue to work through that. But, you know, the reality is that there are more than 7,000 people, adults and children, who are homeless across the state, and we don't have spaces for all of them right now, and we continue to work to build capacity to find permanent housing, to put the programs in place that we can move people from the streets into permanent housing.
All right, we had a caller now from Volcano, Daniel, calling us from Volcano. He wants to ask you about changing the rail.
Thank you.
Aloha, Daniel. Thanks for your patience.
Thank you. I'd like to ask a question with regard to considering a paradigm shift. You can build a magnetic levitation vehicle that weighs 300 pounds on the internet, and it would make it to where everybody could have one. It would also solve a lot of the homelessness issues. Over about 90% of the homeless people, a lot of them have mental problems, and they have their own vehicle, and they can go to the hospital if they need help or they have some other type of health problem. A lot of people are homeless because of other issues, not just mental, but a magnet levitation system is a paradigm shift from the internal combustion engine. And you could do all this overhead, maybe even 20 feet off the ground with 3D printing, and create job opportunity and self-sufficiency instead of importing everything and trying to keep everybody happy. And
Daniel, in the interest of time, let me get the governor to respond to you on that. I mean, we've had many conversations about maglev, but those were near past. We've been watching technology change and accelerate. There have been criticisms that maybe we're looking at, you know, old technology moving into a future that's not going to necessarily welcome it.
Well, I do know that the world is changing faster, and there are more technologies and more opportunities today than there have been in the past. You know, I've talked and I visited with some of those working on autonomous cars, for example, and they work today, and they believe that if you could have a fleet of autonomous vehicles, that you wouldn't need transit systems because they could get a lot more throughput of existing roadways, and they would never crash the car. So I know that all of these technologies are changing all the time, and there are different opportunities for mass transit. I think the HART board needs to be focused on the project and define what it is that they would like to build as, you know, the transit system for Honolulu, and we need to fund it.
Today we saw a Senate version of the health care bill that's meant to replace the ACA, and obviously this is just very, very new, but there are so much concern that Hawaii, which had prepaid health and was a leader in all this, and in the minds of many people, you know, should have been able to continue along its merry way and not have to play into all of this as it has happened over the last 8-9 years. What kind of assurance do you give Hawaii that the kind of health care that will be available here, regardless of what happens federally, will be what we are used to having?
We are fortunate in Hawaii that we have had the Hawaii Prepaid Health Care Act that provided virtually universal health care access to our community for now 45 years. And I think it's evidence specifically that everyone having access to health care works. You know, we are the healthiest state in the country, and we have been for a number of years, longest life expectancy, access to health care, and all of that. I am definitely concerned about the Senate version because it cuts off tens of thousands of our community who currently got and received health care because of the Affordable Care Act. And, you know, we continue to advocate. We are working on contingency plans, but we cannot and we don't have the resources to supplant all of the federal support we get for health care. And that will definitely be a challenge.
What will you ask of Hawaii's insurers?
You know, we are continuing to work with them. I think, you know, the healthcare system in Hawaii, I think, has done a good job of not getting bloated administrative costs. You know, we have a very, very high percentage of the premium dollar that our community pays goes directly into services. And I think that that's something that all of us can be proud of, the insurers, the physicians, the service providers, and the resident. So we will continue to work to improve that system. The prepaid healthcare system does provide a very good foundation.
We could have a whole hour just talking about that, and I'm sure one of these days we will. But I need to ask you one more question before you go, and that's, we're going to blink, and we're going to be in another election cycle, and that includes a re-election bid for you. Now, some have been critical of your more retiring manner, or that you are, you know, much more of a quiet person, and that perhaps Hawaii needs a dynamic personality. There's been speculation that you may be facing several challengers in the primary, that you may not have enough money in your campaign to be able to adequately fund it. How are you processing all this, and what is it that you want the rest of us to know about it?
We are definitely working to get the campaign organized and move forward. We continue to be focused on the work at hand of providing and improving the lives of our community all across the state. I'm proud of the record that we have accomplished. We've done so many things that I think the general public are maybe not so aware of.
So say a couple of them then.
Well, I'm still proud of the fact that Hawaii is the first and only state to be committed to 100% clean, renewable future.
I'm proud. The Paris Accord.
Right, the Paris Accord. Hawaii is still the only state to commit legally to the goals of the Paris Accord. You know, we continue to lead the country in so many different ways. Hawaii Prepaid Health Care Act, Hawaii being the healthiest state, our commitment to quality education, the public school system, you know, making an investment in improving, cooling the schools, I think are all efforts that I'm proud of. Putting our financial house in order, our bond rating upgrade gives us the highest bond rating ever in the state of Hawaii, which reduces the interest costs that we pay. Taking care of the taxpayers' funds is something that I take seriously and personally, and we will continue to do that.
Governor, it's been a real pleasure to sit down with you for this hour, which has flown by, as they usually do. I hope it won't be too terribly long until we sit down for another discussion.
Absolutely. I enjoyed it. I look forward to the next opportunity to have a conversation with both you and the listeners here at the Public Radio.
Thank you very much, Governor Ige. And thank you very much to all of you who joined us today for tuning in and calling us with your questions. We'll be back tomorrow with The Conversation. We'll see you then tomorrow at 11. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Aloha.